Welcome to Bookwaves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Dinao Mengistu, whose latest novel is All Our Names. Earlier novels, The Beautiful Things That Heaven Bears, which I notice is also sold as Children of the Revolution.
In the UK, yes.
And How to Read the Air. Dinao Mengistu was born in Addis Ababa in Ethiopia, immigrated to the United States at age 2, grew up in Peoria, Illinois, and later Forest Park, Illinois. This is your third novel. I noticed that the second novel, much like this one, also has two narratives from two different periods. What attracts you to that form of the novel?
I've always liked novels that don't have a linear narrative. I've never, even my first novel, even though there's only one narrator, it still works in a slightly cyclical pattern. And that's one of the things that I've always liked about writing fiction, is how you can not only create characters, but how you can disturb time a little bit, and how you can make things echo one another across different time periods, across different landscapes. And so I've always liked the idea that, you know, we tend to think of our lives as you wake up on Monday, you're there on Friday, etc. And that linear narrative is a little bit too simple. I think our lives are much more complex, and we sort of actually, our days are interrupted constantly by inflections and memories from the past. And so as much as possible, I've always tried to come up with narrative structures that can mirror that way in which, you know, the past is never really the past. It's always there sort of intruding on our present moment.
And identities are also just as fluid as well.
Exactly, very much so, without a doubt. One of the things that happens across the novel, or one of the ideas that I liked about the novel, is that it challenges the idea that, like, all of our identities are completely one monolithic thing from the day we're born to the day we die. But then, in fact, you know, even though you may never change your name, who you are and how you think of yourself evolves constantly, and you do play multiple roles in your life. You have multiple versions of yourself over the course of your story.
And our hero, who is known as D or Isaac, depending, he's got three different versions: the version he grew up with, the version he had in Uganda when he left Ethiopia, and then his American version. It seems that his friend Isaac also has two versions. And on top of that, Isaac's mentor, Joseph, has multiple versions as well.
Yeah, definitely so. And all of these names are reflective of different periods and different moments in these characters' lives. And the responses to these names are indicative not only of where they are emotionally and psychologically, but oftentimes also of the political circumstances around their lives. And really, I think what happens at the very end, or what happens over the course of the novel, becomes these characters assuming the names that they really want for themselves. You know, there's sort of a great power in being able to decide what your name is and in being able to name things. And as the characters sort of progress, they are kind of, I think, slowly, if not always, assuming or at least accepting the names that they get passed on to them.
Dinao Mengistu, All Our Names is about what happened in Uganda in the late 60s, early 70s, and also at the same time what happened a few years later when our protagonist comes over to America and lives in the town of Laurel, which I guess is kind of Peoria.
Yeah.
I understand the genesis of the book came when you were living in Paris and you had this idea of creating a book about close friends on a campus in Africa in the 60s. Is that right?
Yeah. You know, that was the sort of like the first spark was really like, how can I tell a story that begins in a moment of like great optimism for these young men? You know, and there was this period just after the end of colonialism where there was a lot of sort of rise of enthusiastic and radical politics where people really thought that they were able to assume control over their countries. And so I thought the story really was going to sort of begin and maybe even possibly stay right there in that moment. And I wanted to see how much I could possibly explore that period. And then as I began to do so, I realized the story was going to make its way into America as well, that it was going to cross borders, it was going to cross time periods. Once that began to happen, I realized, so you have that great moment of optimism in Africa that really began in the early 1960s, and in the same way that we had some of that optimism here with the civil rights movement and the way those things were sort of emerging in the early 1960s. But then I began to think about how those moments of optimism were also quickly defeated, how that there was a strong efforts in some cases to sort of undermine those moments of optimism and some of the political power that those people were trying to assume for themselves. So by 1968, you have the assassination of Martin Luther King. By 1968, 69, you have the rise of really strong autocratic regimes across many African countries as well. So you begin to watch how these great dreams, these great periods of hope are slowly diminished.
That means that you were very conscious in creating your parallel lines that the discrimination that Isaac and his girlfriend meet in Laurel in Peoria is kind of equivalent to the changes that the mentor, Joseph, goes through from being an idealistic guy who wants to create democracy to being basically a thug.
Yeah. Everything works out pretty okay, I think, in the novel in terms of the way these periods echo each other and the way these ideas are sort of related between what happens in Kampala and what happens in the small town in the Midwest. But by and large, none of it was ever planned in my head. You know, I just had I had these two different voices. I had the voice of Isaac, one narrator, and Helen, the other, telling the story in the Midwest. And, you know, I don't write with a plan, so it was one voice would tell its story, and then the other voice would suddenly emerge. And after a while, they began to have a conversation with each other, not directly, but as soon as Isaac told his story, then Helen would suddenly come into the story, and she would have her own narrative to tell, and suddenly that narrative would carry echoes of Isaac's story through her experiences, and they began to just sort of build on each other like that really naturally.
So as you were going through it, you would see, okay, this is where I am now, and you move forward a little bit, but it's going to be echoing and speaking in a way to the other section.
Yeah, and I tried actually not to pay attention to those echoes until the book was kind of done. You know, I write very slowly for the most part, so it takes, you know, 4 to 5 years of not doing much else. So you have a really strong memory of everything that you've done because it takes, you know, months to finish a chapter. But once it's done, I try to move on to the next thing. And your brain, fortunately, has a deeper memory sometimes than you're willing to acknowledge. And it remembers that there are those things lurking in the background and they keep reemerging over the course of the novel on their own.
The character of Isaac, or D, as he's, which is actually your nickname, as you said, coming from Ethiopia to Uganda and kind of hanging out on the campus wanting to be a student, which he isn't, and then he goes and becomes Isaac. The first chapter begins Isaac, and yet his best friend is Isaac. And for a second there, I was confused, and that's deliberate on your part.
Yeah, very much so. I wanted to see how much I can hold that in sort of in suspension, what these who these characters really are. You know, it's not that they're that Isaac is an unreliable narrator. He is pretty honest about what's happening to him. But by the time he begins to tell his story, he has really assumed this other identity. That's not who he is when the story begins, but by the time he's actually able to tell the story, he has become this person. He has taken on this name. And for me, a large part of the story was getting the reader to understand how that process happens, right? Like, how does that evolution happen between a young man coming to Kampala, shedding these names that his family has given him, and almost sort of being nameless? You know, he says in the early on in the novel that when I arrived in Kampala, I wanted to think of it as a nameless place, just as the way I thought of myself. So it is the story about how one man acquires an identity over the course of a friendship, over the course of these sort of violent, traumatic experiences that define him.
Well, why at the end of the book, then, did you suddenly give him the letter D?
I wanted to acknowledge a little hint that he had, you know, that someone else knew his name before he became this, you know, and that became that moment where that happens. But I never write out the whole name. You know, there's just the D with the slash because I did want to leave that. Obviously, of course, you're echoing parts of your own life, my own name, my own nickname as well. But it was also as a way of showing that, you know, Isaac did have a history, and he's willingly shed that history in order to take on this new person that he's become.
Well, Isaac and his best Isaac and his best friend Isaac. Yeah. Let's call it Isaac, and the real Isaac. Yeah. Let's say, come under the influence of a man named Joseph Mabira, who's fictional. Yeah. I would assume Mabira is the name of a nature preserve that's being destroyed in Uganda.
You're the first person to look that up. You know, somebody actually also asked me if Joseph was supposed to have any relationship to Joseph Kony, also the sort of violent figure in Uganda. And in some ways, you know, I don't know how deep my brain was or was not working when those names started emerging together. You know, Joseph was also initially the echo of a character that I had created many, many years ago, the sort of kind but ultimately violent man. That was a part of the very first novel that I tried to write. So to some degree, the formation of that character existed slightly there. The same way Isaac actually existed as another character from a novel from that same story from years ago. So both characters were born again in this story. But he is very much a product of my imagination. He is a fictional. He's not supposed to be representative of any one idea, I guess.
And Mabira is the name of this nature preserve, which you deliberately put in there.
Yeah.
Dinah Mengistu, in the story, the first half of the story, we're dealing with the history of Uganda. How familiar were you with that history, and how available is the full history to all of us? I know that Teju Cole, in his most recent novel, talks about how Africans tend to want to forget their recent history.
Yeah. I was fairly familiar with Uganda. I mean, I spent time working there as a journalist, mainly covering the conflict in northern Uganda, partly related to the LRA, but also really about the government's responses to the tragedies that the LRA had inflicted on its population. So I got to know Kampala through that lens, and in the process of writing that, then I began to do sort of a lot of research onto the sort of history and trajectory of the post-independent Uganda. And part of the reason why I settled on this, on Uganda in the capital, was also very much for Makerere University and what a symbolic and significant place it was in the post-independent era, and how a lot of writers and a lot of young intellectuals and academics were drawn to it as a center of African intellectual creativity, energy, all those things were happening there.
Was there any point where you were thinking, maybe I should make it a fictional country?
You know, actually, initially, I didn't actually even name it. It was my editor who suggested. I knew I was always thinking of Kampala and Makerere, and the version of Makerere that I was created was also kind of deep, slightly rooted in the version of Addis Ababa University in Addis. So I knew I was making up one place, but also at the same time deeply rooted in the ideas of what Makerere was. And then I thought, well, maybe I don't have to name this place at all. I can leave it nameless, but my editor was wise enough to suggest that. Then it'll feel too much like a fable and like a myth, and that's not what I wanted as well. I wanted it to be a specific place, but I also wanted to be able to claim ownership over that place and not have the reader feel like they're getting a real narrative or real history of Uganda, but they are getting some elements of that history, definitely.
And so that's why Obote is called the president,
yeah,
and never named by name.
Exactly. And actually, most people oftentimes think that I'm actually writing about Amin at that point in time. It's actually not. It's Obote coming under the threat of Amin, and then Obote reemerges later on again as the president for the second time. But you can also see the sort of slight conflation of Obote's identity with elements of Amin's identity in the construct of the president in the novel.
Also, Joseph almost becomes Amin as
yeah.
well as this goes on, which brings up an interesting point about how, and you've talked about this in interviews, colonialism itself is a form of genocide,
yeah.
and then suddenly post-colonialism becomes genocide.
Yeah, that's really brilliantly put, actually. You know, one of the ideas that have always been important to me, there's this great book by this writer, Sven Lindqvist, called Exterminate All the Brutes, and he develops this idea that really our concept of extermination, our concept of genocide, actually, begins with the colonial era. The colonialism, you know, guises itself slightly under the idea of humanitarian concerns, predicated on the idea that some populations are meant to be extinct, some populations are meant to die off, and therefore it's okay if we aid in that process, and it's actually a humane thing to do so. Without that intellectual base, a lot of colonialism wouldn't have actually been possible. So when countries saw these mass populations being killed off, or they saw them deliberately being massacred, they assumed that this was actually a kind thing to do because nature was going to do it anyway. And the colonialism kind of, you know, sort of evolved its way out from there into creating these sort of artificial nation states. And the post-colonial era, I feel like to some degree, devalued the idea of what a life was in a way. So a lot of these men who came into power had already witnessed how easy it was to kill their own population because that was really part of the legacy that they inherited. And it made death so easy to some degree.
Well, it also shows up in all Our Names, Dinel Mengistu. It shows up in alternating chapters because we have poor Helen, this white girl living in Laurel, Peoria,
yeah.
who was worried about her job, and she's worried about what her boyfriend's going to think of her. And then on the other side, we have people putting guns to their heads and shooting them.
Yeah. She comes under threats in very small ways in comparison to what's happening to Isaac's narrator. And so the oftentimes, by the time he comes to the U.S., he has witnessed that large-scale violence as it begins to really emerge. And he comes here, I wouldn't say that he's skeptical of Helen, but he knows he has a much wiser sense of what's at stake in the world than she does. And so when they begin to try to move their relationship from the private into the public sphere, you can see his sort of resolve not to be cowed by the sort of like forms of discrimination in America because he's seen much worse. He's endured much worse for him. And he knows to be skeptical about people, I think, in a way that she doesn't.
He also has to kind of sit back and go, well, you know, nobody's shooting anybody here either.
Yeah.
No, there's no massacres going on. The first time someone is shot in the book, it's a shock.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's when actually his friend, that is the first time someone is shot, right? It's when his friend actually goes up and takes away the colonel and starts shooting these men. That violence emerges, in my imagination of it, so casually. You know, like there isn't sort of a great sort of drum up to the violence, but it should happen in a way that seems almost not indiscriminate, but almost inconsequential. You know, there's that line where the characters talk about seven people had died. It finally felt like a war now because those were sort of almost natural pathways of expression for these men at that time.
And then later on when we have, well, you know, a massacre in which people used machetes off camera. Yeah. We don't actually see it. It's yet another step, and it's so shocking to actually have that be happening, in a sense, in front of our eyes.
Yeah, yeah. And the idea of that massacre that does happen in the story, which, you know, as much as possible, I try to write it off-scene and almost in a certain slow-motion sort of way, was echoed by a group of villagers that I met in Eastern Congo who talked about, really, for them, what they were watching is the sort of a nation-state that had failed itself so completely and its population so completely, where no one had any belief or confidence that the government would ever do anything to support them. And so they felt their lives were ultimately completely precarious. They felt like they had very little control over what would happen to them to the next day. They were constantly under attack. And that if anybody knew that were to step into the village or try to take any of the very small resources they had left, they would kill automatically to defend it. They weren't going to kill out of hatred, out of ethnic violence, out of religious violence. They were killing to defend what little they had left. And for them, it was seen more as a form of self-preservation. And as much as possible, I wanted that idea to be present in the novel, that these villagers are sort of attacking this group of refugees, not because they hate them, but because they know that they're under threat. They know that their country's falling apart. And as that country falls apart, they know that they are going to be left with less and less. And anybody that steps into that zone, that steps into their home, is a possible threat, and they'd rather attack than wait to be killed themselves.
This presents another element of the story, which is the nature of identity, what separates us from them. I understand that you read a 1966 novel by Taieb Salehi called Season of Migration to the North, and this prompted this strain of thought.
Yeah, Salehi's novel was sort of essential to the writing of this book. I kind of return to it constantly, and there are strong, deliberate echoes to that novel where a young man who is born in sort of Sudan goes abroad and is eventually sort of brought back home, or decides to come back home to Sudan. So there's this sort of sense of the value and the stakes of what happens in lives in Africa versus the world and the experiences that are happening abroad. But there's also this sort of one remarkable line where Salehi's talking about the sort of frustration of the governments in Sudan in the late 1960s, and the fact that all these forms of corruption were sort of starting to become evident and people were growing increasingly despondent towards their government. They were beginning to feel like they actually had less and less to believe in. And I had that same exact conversation with people when I was in Sudan in 2006, and that same conversation with people in Eastern Congo in 2010. So you realize this conversation has been happening now for 40-something years. That level of alienation from your country, that sense of really not being a part of a real functioning state, the way that sort of pervades its way down generation through generation, makes some of that sort of violence not endemic, but it becomes a form of expression in many ways.
Not to get too far afield, but okay, we bring it up and we talk about it, but, you know, when you have all these failed states and you have all these people struggling just to stay alive, how do you stop the violence? Can you stop it?
That's a good question. I think you can, of course, definitely stop the violence. For a long time, I tend to believe that you need to restore the institutional power of governments to some degree, right? Beginning especially with some forms of justice, that people need to believe that they don't have to have violence as a recourse. Because in by and large, violence is a form of expression in most of these cases. You know, people in power will use ethnicity as a way of creating political divisions, or they use politics as the fundamental division, and ethnicity is a tool of politics. Controlling that, I think, is essential, right? Not allowing people to feel like the only way that they can stay in power is by fracturing their society into X clan and Y clan and X religion versus Y religion. That becomes a tool of politics. But then, too, at the same time, it's allowing people to feel like they have other recourses to express their frustration other than violence. And when you have governments that have failed so thoroughly, so completely in some ways, violence becomes the only natural language that's left, so to some degree. Like, how else do you express the fact that you have no security, you have no food, you have no access to care, and at the same time, you are constantly under threat by the government itself? Well, then violence becomes an extension of that frustration.
It also translates into these, from our perspective, bizarre battles between tribes of people. It's not really presented strongly in All Our Names, but again, getting back to Teju Cole, it's very present today in a place like Nigeria.
Yeah, without a doubt. Not only sort of divisions of ethnicity, but also divisions of religion. You know, and I do still tend to believe that those divisions are ultimately the arbitrary choices of people who are trying to maintain power, that the real sort of drive and goal and intent is to maintain some form of political power over a population, over an entire country. And because these systems of democracy are so corrupt, that the way to sort of do that is to make sure that you align yourself with whatever faction will help you maintain that power the most. And so you carve up your country, you carve up your society into those divisions in order to do that.
Then what's the point of Museveni's anti-gay rhetoric and murders?
I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that he's been in power. He will have been in power now for almost 30 years. He will have outlasted four U.S. presidents. When Clinton came to power, he said, this is one of our new leaders, one of the new generation of African leaders. So that was Clinton, and now we've gone through two terms of Bush, and we'll go through two terms of Obama. And possibly Museveni would like to pass it down to his son. You also have an economy that's going through increasing struggles. You have rising HIV rates as the government fails to keep providing antiviral therapy for its population. So you need a new nemesis. There's an easy one right there.
Then you've also got the influence of the fundamentalists from America. Yeah.
Yeah, and you have the fundamental Americans who come in, and their interest as well is it's still tied into the weakness of the state, right? Because a lot of their influence comes in the fact that they're able to provide social services. So their power, they gain power across Africa, not just in Uganda, but across the whole continent. You can see their influences by creating farms, by creating schools. And all they ask for in a seemingly benign way is space. So they say, well, let us have this village, let us have this farm, we'll give you great resources. And then really quickly they begin to introduce a radical strain of fundamental Christianity inside of their country. But the only reason why they're able to even get there is because you have governments that are failing to do some of the things that they should have been doing anyway, right? They're not protecting their population. They're not providing the right resources for their citizens, even though they have those resources within their reach.
You also are a reporter and have been a reporter for Rolling Stone, several other places, and you go to Africa frequently. How do you think the American media covers Africa?
It depends when they cover it, is the hard thing. I spent 5 years living abroad in Paris, and what I saw was that there's a drastic, drastic divide between the way the world is reported, the way we report it here. So I tend to think that we just tend to ignore it, and when we do tend to cover it, we cover it in the simplest, quickest possible terms, which is really, I think, why I was interested in becoming a journalist, was watching the first coverage of Sudan and Darfur. We cover it from oftentimes this perspective of a humanitarian aid sort of relationship, right? Like, what can we do to save? And like, there was the Save Darfur campaign, and you wanted to just argue that you can't save. Your role is not to save. At the very least, at the very best, perhaps your role is to try to understand. I don't really ask for people or think people should try to do much more than that. But oftentimes the media defeats even that possibility by reducing narratives into very simple strands of thought. So if you say something is hell, as the reader, you've already decided what that means. You've decided the totality of this life, of this conflict. It's hell. What else do you need to know about hell other than you don't want to be there?
What happens with issues like the Kony story? How do we deal with that, or with the president of Rwanda, who's considered a good guy and yet sends troops into the Congo to foment civil war?
Of course. With the Kony thing, by and large, my sort of greatest frustration with that, and Teju and I were very much sort of, and still continue to have this conversation sometimes, is that it places the sort of center of action on the feeling that we get from inside of this country, right? So the idea is that we have to go inside and capture Kony because this is a sort of an awful man. Of course he's an awful man. That doesn't deny that, but the advocacy in order to do so placed the emphasis on us feeling good about our ideas of having, again, saved this population. And in order to elicit that response from people in America, they distorted the reality so severely that it was no longer about Kony, but really about us, about what we needed to do. And you can almost see the sort of strain between that and the sort of evangelical Protestantism that's sort of rising through the country. These things are so closely aligned. And colonialism, you know, had its birth as this idea of wanting to save the savages if we weren't going to exterminate them. So those two strains were always working in tandem.
Dinao Mengistu, let's switch gears a little bit. Okay, you grew up in Peoria and in suburb of Chicago. Did you read a lot? When did you want to become a writer? How did that work?
I did read a lot. I read it a lot when I was young and then really fell deeply into reading when I was in high school. I went to an all-white conservative high school that was fairly affluent, even though we were not. But the school was very openly racist when I arrived, and what few minorities were there were African Americans, and so I felt slightly alienated from that community, given the fact that I was raised in an African home. It's a different background and a different cultural experience, and so my reaction, by and large, was to move towards books, and books became sort of a saving grace for me for many years, where I learned that I stopped caring what people said about me and whether or not I had any friends, and learned to spend a lot of my time reading. So I spent most of my last years in high school, at the public library, buying books on the used book sales that they'd have for like a quarter. And then slowly, piece by piece, starting to write because I realized there's so much pleasure and beauty in a sentence.
Did you, along with so many other people at the age of 15, read a lot of science fiction?
I didn't read science fiction. I did read horror. So I did sort of begin with like the sort of Stephen King stories. Those were some of the first, actually maybe even slightly younger with King. And I loved those stories. And then from there, it sort of evolved into like, you know, the Beats and then, or maybe Salinger. Then that led me to the Beats. And I stayed with sort of the poetry of Ferlinghetti and Ginsberg and Kerouac for a very long time in Corso. And then continued to sort of evolve from there.
You knew, of course, that in America, we were not hearing about voices from, say, Africa. We were beginning to hear about voices. We were hearing about voices from South America, the magic realists, but we were not hearing about Africa.
Yeah. You know, I think a large part of that was, you know, there's only a handful of sort of large post-colonial novelists that made their way here. So obviously, of course, you have Achebe and Soyinka and Ngugi wa Thiong'o. But somebody like Tayeb Salah, whose work is so seminal and so important, is still relatively unknown. And then, too, in the States, there wasn't an African population really in the U.S. because why would you have come here? The civil rights movement needed to do its work by and large in order to make this country a place for African migrants to want to come. So, you know, when my parents came here, they knew of American racism because they heard about it, but they had, of course, no idea what it meant. They were Ethiopian. They had no idea what black even was as a concept, the way we inhabit it here. So once that began to happen, then you realize there's this, as a writer for me, it became interesting because there's a space that was open in English, in American literature that hadn't really been filled yet.
And as you began writing, you began to see that, and I guess that's where the first novel came from.
You know, the really first novel that I tried to write was actually set in a small town very closely related to Peoria. All my characters were named Jim and Henry and Bill and Sarah and Tom and Joseph and Isaac. They had no color. They had no real history other than this sort of small town, and they all had troubles dealing with violence in some ways. But I was really afraid to try to write from any direct experience or from any sense that I can write about characters who can be in the Midwest but don't have to be, you know, completely denuded of any ethnicity. They can actually have a name like Dina Mengestu. They can have a name like Sefa Stefano, so the narrator of my first novel. And that's okay. That's permissible, actually, and there's nothing doesn't make the novel more marginal as a result of that.
You mentioned before that you felt a little alienated from the American, African-American community. How did they respond to you? I mean, what did they think?
Part of it was that we hadn't grown familiar with this story yet. In Forest Park, Illinois, Imperial, Illinois, there weren't other African migrants that could sort of say, well, we all share this sort of common experience of being black in America. So that experience I know very well, right? I know what it is to be discriminated against, to have the police take you down for no reason. But those are only one facet of your identity. Then you have all the sort of other cultural experiences. And by and large, African Americans are the foundation of this country, the same way that European Americans would be. Whereas African migrants, we come here with the privilege of migrants. You know, we come here slightly without any deep sense of history, so we are permitted and we allow ourselves to think, of course, my children aren't going to be discriminated against because I don't even know what that is. As I've grown older, I think that story has grown more and more complex, and my books oftentimes have tried to work through that issue. My first novel was very closely dealt with the relationship between an African immigrant and this African-American community that he lives in that's also being gentrified.
Well, I notice in books by Chinese Americans who have come over at similar times and, you know, grew up in America, the same idea that the immigrant story that we are told as Americans is a very different story than the story of immigrants coming from Africa or China or other places, even South America we get a little, but not really South America.
Yeah, no, I think you're right, completely. We became very familiar with one standard form of the migrant narrative that comes, you know, that sort of worked its way from Europe over to here. And I think now what we're doing is we're complicating that story, but we're also really, I think, pushing forward on the idea of what American literature and what an American identity is, you know, that it's not, you know, I am, of course, an immigrant and a migrant in many ways, but you're also arguing that what happens is America's always been a process, that narrative has always been a part of this country's history. We're just making sure it's no longer occupied by just one form. It's not just one story. It's not just the sort of story of somebody comes and they pull themselves up by the bootstrap, but that many people don't, and many people can't.
Dina Mengestu, as I was doing my research, my first thought was, there's this new literature of the African diaspora, people like Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, Teju Cole, you, Helen Oyeyemi, others. And then I began thinking about the Chinese one. Then I realized you all have one thing in common. You're approximately the same age. You're sort of halfway between first and second generation Americans and every single immigrant generation of the same sort, first into second, whether they be Italians or Jews from Eastern Europe, whatever, had that same exploring and flowering of literature.
Yeah, yeah. And I think oftentimes what we all tend to also be doing is telling stories that weren't ours. You know, we oftentimes are filling in stories that were the experiences of the generation that preceded us. But our gift has been language in many ways. We've had the privilege of being able to take those missing narratives and continue that conversation by writing them out. So if you think of like Chimamanda's second book, Half a Yellow Sun, she's talking about the war in Biafra, which would have happened when she was before she was born. Teju keeps things a little bit more contemporary, but Yiyun Lee is also writing oftentimes an experience that would have preceded her life. Daniel Alarcón as well. So you can see us working our way through these voids, through these empty spaces in history, and bringing them here and bringing them alive.
Well, when you look back at that history over there, how does it make you feel? Do you feel torn between America and Africa? Do you feel fully American? How do you feel?
Well, I've argued that my idea of what it is to be American means that I can hold multiple things.
Going back to what you had said
exactly.
Before.
You know, for a long time, I felt like I had to switch. And one of the things that frustrated me sometimes about my first novel being published is seeing people say, Ethiopian writer, Dinah Mengesu. And I found that frustrating because my identity has always been also deeply rooted in America. So to say that somehow I'm not American now, to me, is to deny me a natural part of who I am. I came here when I was 2 years old. I didn't go back to Ethiopia until I was 25. I don't think I could be any more American. And yet at the same time, I'm deeply invested in not only in Ethiopia, but also what happens in Africa. And so I think of myself as being very much a product of both places equally. And no one gets to claim me any more than the other.
Would you have felt better if you'd taken a pseudonym like John Doe?
I keep trying to find out new ways of how to rebrand myself. And so I was joking that I was thinking quietly that if there was, you know, sort of rather than the immigrant narrator or the Ethiopian-American writer, that I wanted to sort of come up with myself as like the Puria-raised writer and see if that changes the way people sort of approach my books, or the writer from the working middle class, all these different ways that we use of branding each other.
Let's go back. You read a lot, and you began writing on your own. Poetry or what?
I tried poetry really early, but I realized I love poetry. And if you love something, you try to respect it. And I realized I should respect it enough not to do it. But I still read poetry a lot, and poetry has been really influential in the way I think about language. And a lot of poems, I used to have a habit, unfortunately slightly lost, but to memorize poems and to keep them in my head while I wrote.
And then you began work on this first novel you never published?
Yeah.
After that, did you send it out or did you put it aside or what?
I sent it to everyone who could possibly have anything to do with it in New York, and everyone kindly rejected it. And eventually I think I needed to go through that process because, one, you need to know that you can fail after years and years of work. And that was 4 years of work on that first book, and still continue to do something because you love it and because there's no other choice for you.
And then what happened with The Beautiful Things?
And then The Beautiful Things, fortunately, came kind of quickly. There was an Ethiopian man standing in the counter behind the counter of a small grocery store in D.C., and I was feeling a little, you know, sort of slightly depressed that I had failed my first novel. And suddenly this voice popped into my head of this very sort of lonely middle-aged man who said, "No one comes into the store anymore." And then suddenly a novel was born 3 years later.
And then after that, of course, you're stuck because you've written your first novel. I guess you sent it out, and this time an agent said,
Unfortunately, the second time, I don't know what I would have done it to. I probably would have kept writing, I'm sure. But
at that point, were you thinking of doing reportage too? Or?
No, I mean, in some ways, The Beautiful Things gave me the desire to want to do that, because part of what happened while writing that novel was I was doing this sort of, just for unknown reasons or reasons I can't remember, like research into all the sort of history of coups across Africa's history. And the characters in the novel make it into a joke where they make it into a very private, dark joke about knowing the different acronyms for all the different rebel leaders across the country or across the continent. And in the process of doing that, I began to have this idea that, you know, I do that because it's important to be able to name these things in order to know who these men are, so that way these stories don't just seem like episodes of violence or stories of coups, but that in fact there are individual men who are responsible for them. And then I thought, well, it'd be really interesting to meet these men sometime. So really it was fiction that inspired me to want to do the nonfiction.
Well, when you met these men and you knew what they had done or were going to do, what is going on in your mind? It's like the character of Dee first meeting Joseph. How do you think about that?
I've only met a few, and they've always met them in strange circumstances. One was a Darfur rebel leader named Minnie Manawi, who I went to Sudan to try to find and sort of chased him around for a while trying to get in touch with him. And then eventually he was signed a peace agreement with the government and was brought to the U.S. to meet then-President Bush. So I actually met him at a hotel in Washington, D.C. after his meeting with the president. And at that point in time, you could see the violence. His faction of the rebels had turned increasingly more violent against the civilian population. And what you see inside of them is somebody who has come to this position almost by accident. And that was the sort of surprising thing, was that he talked about, wanting to have schools for his community, not having hospitals for their children, and that's why they took up arms. And I know that's true, but by the time he had achieved this thing where he was having a meeting with the president of the United States, it all seemed fairly like accident, like the violence had sort of escalated and grown, and other people had stepped in to try to solve it without really knowing what they were trying to solve, and somehow this man became where he was. And as far as I know now, he occupies very little influence in the government.
How does that relate to somebody like your fictional Joseph Mabera?
The character of Joseph in the novel he's a man who commits great violence. He's a bit more of an intellectual, but he is also a man whose violence is sort of initially born out of this desire to liberate his people, to feel like this government has failed and the only way out is to take it over. But then in the process of doing so, you can see him or understand that his desire to do so becomes warped by the sort of violence that accompanies it. There's a colonel in the Congolese army that I met in eastern Congo who actually was more inspirational, who was a very strong man and a very respectable man in many ways and really seemed beloved by his soldiers. But he also talked very casually about the way that they would go off and crush these different rebel factions and groups that were out there threatening the government. And a lot of these rebel factions and groups, while they're problematic, existed because they were felt threatened by the military themselves. So you could see within his rhetoric this desire to believe that he will help make his country a better place, but that in order to do so, he will also commit acts of violence that aren't necessary.
It makes someone like Nelson Mandela stand out even more, I think.
Yeah, without a doubt. And it's also why when you don't have someone like that at the very top of your government, it's very, very hard to inspire others to believe the same thing. The violence trickles its way down. And in Eastern Congo, or in Congo, you have the president who came to power through violence, and that violence continues to seep its way down through the military, through the population.
Dino Mengistu, All Our Names has come out. Have you begun thinking about another book?
There's something small, quietly, very, 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 very quietly trying to emerge. And, this novel and the other two novels were all very closely related, and I think what happens next will be something hopefully completely different.
Well, you talk about it in an interview. You call it a triptych. Why?
Yeah. One novel was always waiting in the wings before the other was even finished. So before The Beautiful Things was done, How to Read the Air had already begun, not in great depth, but I knew that there was a character who was picking up another strand of a conversation. And the same thing with How to Read the Air. When I was maybe three quarters of the way done with that, this novel began. And I realized there was another idea that I hadn't quite explored yet about this.
One final question. Beautiful Things, you said, was renamed in England as Children of the Revolution. What was that about?
That was actually the initial title, was Children of the Revolution, from the T-Rex song. There's a scene in the novel where the characters are at a bar and they hear the T-Rex song, Children of the Revolution, and they think the song is briefly about them. And so they would have this tradition of standing up and singing it. And my American publisher at the time, or not my editor, but the marketing department, thought perhaps that would scare off potential readers as sounding overly political. And the British thought the American title was very weak.
And where did you come up with All Our Names?
Well, that was almost the title from the very beginning. In the draft, in the line that never made it, and it was one of the first sentences in the early versions of the book, there was a larger cast of friends who were naming themselves after musicians and after military leaders. And the character throughout the line, something around, we have many names, these are all our names. And then from there, the sort of idea grew about how much could I play with the idea of naming over the course of the novel. And there's a lot of names over the course of the book.
But as you said early on in the interview, you can't get too caught up in that because suddenly that constricts your imagination.
Exactly. I think so.
You've been listening to an interview with Dinao Mengistu, whose latest novel is All Our Names. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.